Welcome to University Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri, Director of Communications and Alumni Relations here at the University of Malta. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research projects, their international networks, about their aims and aspirations. I shall also be hearing from staff and students and visitors to campus about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. I'm delighted to have with me today in the studio of University Matters here at Campus FM two guests, Dr. Timothy Gambin and Dr. Christopher Clark. And they are experts in a field that I love very much, and that's archaeology, particularly maritime archaeology, in fact, in the case of definitely Timothy Gambin. Dr. Gambin is Director of Archaeology of the Aurora Trust. Perhaps he'll tell us a brief word about that. And also visiting lecturer at the Department of Classics and Archaeology at the University of Malta. Just a word about Dr. Clark. He is an associate professor of computer science at Cal Poly. His teaching and research are focused on the field of autonomous robot systems. Two of his main research thrusts include developing methods for many robots to work together and using underwater robots to help collect data for archaeologists, biologists and oceanographers. Well, that rather sets the scene for what our chat is going to be about today. Dr. Gambin, this isn't the first time you've been on the programme to tell us about your work. How far has the project got to today? How are you moving forward with it?
Well, this project started as a dream. I was once in a lecture by Professor Wettinger, and he mentioned that the wells and cisterns of Malta would be one of the last frontiers to explore to gather new evidence, and that was the statement that stuck in my head. But my work as an underwater archaeologist has brought me in touch with certain technologies which we've used to explore the seabed. And I began to formulate the idea of using some of the technologies that I was coming across in the field of underwater archaeology to fulfill that the dream of exploring wells and cisterns on the islands of Malta and Gozo. I was very lucky to start the project in 2006 in a very reduced way. And we were even luckier that in a conference after where a colleague of mine was presenting our work of 2006, met Chris Clark, who was carrying out sort of parallel research using similar technologies. And since then, this is basically our third season working together with Professor Clark. And since the first time that Professor Clark visited Malta, we've gone from strength to strength.
So I could turn to Professor Clark and ask a little bit about Cal Poly, because perhaps it won't be so familiar to our listeners, and also how you became really involved, what interested you about this particular project.
Okay, thanks for having me, first of all. So Cal Poly it's short for California Polytechnic State University, but everyone goes by Cal Poly. It's a primarily teaching university. It does have a master's program, but it's primarily undergraduate teaching based, and it's located on the California coast, right between Los Angeles and San Francisco. The philosophy of the university is what we call learn by doing, which is not just giving the theory on the board, but actually getting the students, getting them dirty with their hands and actually doing things that they're going to use when they go to work.
To actually do this, of course, it requires financing, and you were lucky enough to get a grant to carry on this work over here in Europe.
Yeah, and so I think with our previous collaborations, we've sort of demonstrated that, one, that we can work together well, and we can generate the type of science and data that's very valuable to a large number of people, the scientists and the archaeologists. And so the National Science Foundation from America has funded the next 3 years of our research.
Dr. Gambin was saying that he realized you were doing parallel work, and therefore that, you know, he was interested in having this link up between you and what his project is about. In what way is it parallel to what he's doing?
So I'm obviously coming from the project from a really different point of view. I'm much more on the technology side, and what excites me is the application often. And I think what the cistern mapping project is a really exciting application. And what's great about it is it doesn't just excite me, but the students who are typically, you know, a computer scientist is often viewed as someone who sits in front of a computer all day and types. And this gets the students out of the chairs and really gets them doing something that they've never seen or could even imagine that they'd be able to do.
So these wells and systems create challenges from the technical point of view. I mean, you're producing robots, but obviously these robots need to be adapted to particular places, particular venues for their use.
Yeah, and there's a lot of difficulties when you're going to a new spot you've never been to. You don't know what it's going to be like. We've had cisterns where we've actually had to, you know, basically unscrew all the undercarriage of the robot, leaving it imbalanced, and then we sort of tape on weights here and there over the robot just to let it squeeze through the small passageway into the tunnel. So we're constantly having to adapt both the hardware and the software to make it work for this.
Mm, and probably literally getting your hands dirty.
Very dirty sometimes.
Dr. Gambin, what are you physically doing yourself now with this project? How is it moving on?
Well, besides the logistical direction of many aspects of the project, I work in close collaboration with, obviously, Professor Clark, but also with Keith Buhajar locally. Keith Buhajar is our leading expert on water management systems in the Middle Ages and in the past, basically. And
perhaps I could interrupt here just briefly to explain a little bit what you mean by water systems and galleries, because this is something, I mean, I've been on tours of galleries with Keith Buhajar and with yourself, and so I know a little bit about it, but I'm sure it's not something that's familiar to the average listener.
There are two aspects which we look at. One is the typology of water management systems, so whether it is a simply bell-shaped well which is collecting water from a roof, or it could be a system which taps into the local water aquifer with a system of tunnels, or it could be a water gallery in the rural areas of Malta, which again taps into the water aquifer, but it is the water aquifer is managed through a number of tunnels. So just by looking at the wellhead from the surface, one doesn't quite realize what one is dealing with. So through the exploration with these robots, we're able to not only identify what type of water management system we're looking at, but we're also able to map them and map the extent. The other aspect is related to reutilization. So, for example, in a place like Mdina, you may have what is very clearly a Baroque house with a number of wellheads. However, when one explores these wells with a robot, it is clear that some of the systems even predate Roman times, which is common sense, really, because if one is rebuilding a house or extending a house, the last thing you'd want to do is cut into the rock and make a new cistern or a new well from scratch, start a new well from scratch, and therefore what we're finding is that many of the wellheads have subsequent periods of extending the actual shaft.
Sometimes one looks around the countryside and you look at a hillside and you think, gosh, that's very fertile. I wonder where on earth they're getting their water from. And I must say, I had never realized until I was told that there were these gallery systems that the farmers have been using for centuries, if not millennia.
In the first season that we worked with Professor Clark, we concentrated on urban, on the ancient urban centers, such as Mdina and the Citadel in Gozo. However, starting from last year, we expanded out to, thanks to the help from Keith Buhajar, to start exploring some of these rural water galleries. And maybe Chris can take it from here, but they are very expansive.
Yes, tell us about them.
I mean, this is one of the exciting things. You don't know, I mean, the students and I, when we come, we don't know what to expect in terms of the shapes and sizes. And we get some that are quite small, but when we get to these bigger galleries, they can extend, you know, much farther than even our robot can reach when it's attached with what we call a tether or a cable that lets us sort of see what the robot can see. So not only do you get these longer tunnels, but you also get different tunnels jutting out in different passageways, and it's quite exciting to see, which parts of the different local areas are connected through the different tunnel systems.
And these would have been hand dug, not natural phenomena.
I'm not sure if I'm the right person to ask that question, but it seems to be quite varied from what we've seen.
I think Keith has confirmed that the majority of them are dug by hand.
And you're doing this work together, but you also have students involved in this or not?
We actually recruit a team of students to come with us, and a big part of this project is, like I said before, getting students who are excited to do things that they don't get a chance to do. And right now we've got a team of 8 students here this year, and we have 4 of them working on the robot technology and getting the hardware set up to actually collect the data and make 3-dimensional maps, which is something we haven't tried before. And we also have a new direction, which is to use 4 of the students to come up with 3D visualizations, to actually take pictures of the cisterns and sort of embed them within these 3D visualizations. That's actually led by Dr. Zoe Wood, another professor on this project. So the students' involvement is crucial and very intense, I would say.
Dr. Gumbin, I'm going to ask a sort of provocative question. Why bother to map these galleries, both the urban ones and the rural ones? What are the various reasons for doing it? What can we get out of it at the end of the day?
That's a very good question. One of the things that Professor Clark and I have been discussing over the past days is the creation of a database. Now, we appreciate that some of the persons who gave us access to their wells wish to remain anonymous, but however, we still can map the typology, the chronology of the site, what technology was used, what kind of data we gathered, so researchers in the future who may be sort of honing in on Roman water management or water management in the Roman, in the Punic or Roman periods, may actually use these data sets, which would be available through a database, which would be available locally through a database. The other aspect is that today we have access to certain sites, which we may not have access to in the future. The owners of properties may change, so we have the opportunity, we have the technology available, so we're trying to map as many sites as possible for future generations to use, and also current generations of researchers.
Because you're looking at it from a technical point of view, there is an archaeological point of view, there is a sociological point of view as well. I mean, I'm thinking of the rural ones in particular. You're looking back at life a long time ago and trying to analyse how they managed to create the rural systems that were prevalent in, the Middle Ages, and how perhaps they've also changed over the years. There must be different aspects of this interesting to different researchers.
It is. We are quite aware from an international scene that many thinkers have stated that the next war will be fought over water. And we're obviously dealing in a much smaller scale here. So we are very aware that we're dealing with a very fragile a very fragile resource. What is incredible, what is coming to light, is that systems which were prepared and excavated and prepared in the Middle Ages are still being utilized today in very much the same way. Well, what is different is that rather than bringing the water up by some manual pump, today they're using the electric pumps. But however, these water galleries are still very much part of the rural fabric of Malta in the 21st century.
And it is a way of irrigating the land without lowering the water table, really. It's a natural phenomenon. Okay, you're mentioning electric pumps, which I suppose might sort of make a difference, but fundamentally it is a natural phenomenon, this idea of the perched aquifer.
I believe that if managed properly, it is a resource which can be continued to be utilized and in to use a modern catchphrase, in a sustainable way. The million-dollar question mark is always related to the management of that resource. So it really and truly it goes beyond the the scope of what we're doing. We're sort of focusing on our technological and historical research, but our project can't but help shed light on this fascinating resource.
From the archaeological point of view, normally an archaeologist goes on a dig and there's an excavation and he or she finds or doesn't find things that are related to the time of the excavation. In this case, perhaps in not so much in the rural galleries, but in the urban situations, have you come across wells having been used as a bit of a dump and therefore of interest from the archaeological point of view, or are they always kept very, very clean and clear?
In the main, they've been kept very clean and clear. And in the first season, we were thinking that there may be sort of some forms of some form of remains related to human use, like, I don't know, clay pots which may have been dropped accidentally. But really and truly, most of the sites we've explored are pretty clean.
Because I suppose water was always at a premium here, so it was always important to keep them well honed.
And the other thing is, just on a lighter note, there's, in the wells we've explored in Mdina, there's no sign of the urban legend related to the treasures being hidden from Napoleon.
So. You didn't find them at the bottom.
Absolutely not.
Well, it's still a bit of a holy grail, you know. You never know. In the next well. Definitely. Professor Clark, it's a non-invasive way, isn't it, this robot idea? It's a non-invasive way of examining what is, in inverted commas, an excavation site.
I think the way we're using the robot, it's really, we're lowering it down into the cistern water or the gallery water, and we're trying to drive it around without leaving anything behind. The sensing we're doing is using a scanning sonar that sort of rotates around in a circle and tries to get range measurements to all the different sides of the cistern, basically trying to get distances to the cistern walls. And it's just sending basically sound waves into the water, which really isn't going to do much damage to anything down there.
No fish around to kill off.
We haven't seen too much fish swimming down there.
We saw a frog, though, in one of us.
I'm sure you did, and a few newts and that kind of thing. The purpose, as you say, you're bringing these students, coming to Malta, they're having an opportunity to use this machinery with their own hands, to see it in use in perhaps environments which they wouldn't find exactly like them at home. But there's a grander picture, really, in the idea of bringing the students over to Europe. There is also the sort of the cultural dimension as well.
Yeah, and you have to understand, too, many of the students from our university don't leave America. Many of them have never left California. So this is a real eye-opening experience just for the travel's sake. But half of the program's goals are actually to expose these students to a foreign place and how to work abroad, deal with differences in culture, deal with a new place. And so we actually spend quite a bit of time training on, for example, whatever country that we're going to travel to. So we actually have, not only am I here sort of leading, I'm the sort of the techno lead, but we have Professor Jane Lair from Ethnic Studies at Cal Poly, and she's been leading the effort in teaching about Maltese history, Maltese culture, food, the language, everything that you might want to learn about a country you're going to visit, and doing it actually from a very intellectual side, not just sort of streaming through the facts, but really trying to understand why are decisions made, why are things the way they are here. And just even in doing that for one country, you know, coming from America, there's quite a bit of information leaving America and not as much from the world coming in that we'd like. These students are getting a whole different picture of you know, the world's perspective in some way by coming to this country.
What do you feel has been their reaction on the whole? Were they interested?
Yeah, and I sort of sat them down one by one a couple nights ago and tried to ask them these types of questions, and for the most part they're quite amazed at what they're seeing. They're amazed both at, you know, once you leave the computer, how many difficult things there are, and how great it is when you sort of get through a problem. But a lot of it is really just being amazed at Malta and the history and culture, and just it's so different for them. The signs are different, that you drive on a different side of the road, maybe. I mean, all these different things really put the students just on high alert. It's like they're wide-eyed for, you know, they're here for 4 weeks and they've been wide-eyed ever since they got here. So it's a pretty amazing experience for them.
4 weeks, it's a good amount of time, isn't it? What about our own students? I know that you're very keen that the projects that you're on, and I think it's one of the raison d'etre of these projects, is that you get out to as many people as possible. I mean, jokingly, we were saying before we went on air that we try to get the most out of our guests and make them work very hard. What have you been doing on the local scene?
So, on the local scene, we've made contact with a number of schools. I'm a firm believer in taking research which is done at university level, and I wouldn't say simplifying it, but rather remodeling it for secondary school students, and in this case primary school students. The eight Cal Poly visitors will be visiting a number of primary schools in Malta, taking approximately eight robots. This is a program which they actually conduct back in California, so we're going to import this program. And besides being talked about, being spoken to about robots, they will actually get hands-on experience to program these small robots and actually have fun with education, and trying to marry education and fun. And I think Chris can speak to us about the second contact we're going to have with another level of local students.
Mm-hmm. What we've done in California is we've gone to second graders, and that's what we're going to bring here.
Those would be how old?
Second graders. They are 8 years old.
Oh, quite young then.
Yeah. So what we're doing with that respect is we're actually taking these small robots and letting the students program them with really simple means. Now, with the university here itself, I've been meeting with Dr. Simon Fabry in engineering, and we're trying to create some connections at this sort of engineering level, university level. So we actually share quite a bit of common interest in terms of robot technology, autonomy, intelligent vehicles, and things like that. And those are sort of some of my main research interests. I'm going to be giving a seminar today and next week on this subject. But we're also going to be getting together, I think, socially, and to sort of discuss, you know, this particular field of research.
Well, that's the networking, isn't it? I mean, it's important that you should get to know also what's going on in even in our university in this particular subject. And I know that there are academics who are working in that area.
Yeah, and they're doing very well. And it's always great when you can get together and just sort of see the different approaches to some of the same problems.
Well, I'm sure they'll appreciate that very much. What's the next step, Tim?
After three seasons working in Malta and through the funding that was secured by Professor Clark, the next step is to consolidate the model of data capture in order to take it forward, to consolidate this database of the sites we've explored, and see if how successful we are in exporting it to the next European country that Cal Poly will be visiting. So a bit of a Maltese-American connection, and seeing if it can work in a place like Spain, for example.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you both very much, Dr. Timothy Gambin and Professor Christopher Clark, for coming on the programme today, University Matters on Campus FM. And I look forward to the next opportunity to hear about the next stage in the project in the near future. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to today's program. I do hope you can join us again next week for another in the series University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.